This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the past 5 years, hundreds of thousands of Americans have come home from duty in Afghanistan and Iraq. One way or another, they're all changed by the experience of war. To a later, greater or lesser degree, the house, the town, the country they return to is different, too. Since June, the New York Times has been hosting a blog called Home Fires, where five people who served in the military share their thoughts, feelings, and observations about coming home from Iraq. Today, we talk with two of the five veterans featured on Home Fires, Mike Jernigan, who lost his sight after being wounded by a roadside bomb. He's now turned to writing, and he's now a college student. And Sandy Austin, a former liaison to the governor of Nineveh province, who refers to the journal she kept in Iraq to reflect on the differences with life back at home. Later on in the hour, the Motley Fool's regular monthly visit. So if you have questions about investments in the markets, you can send them in now by email, talk@npr.org. But first, transitioning to life on the home front, and we want to hear from veterans today of every era. Call and tell us your story about coming home. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Michael Jernigan. He's a retired Marine corporal and has been blogging on home fires. You may recognize him as one of the veterans featured in the HBO documentary Alive Day Memories, Home from Iraq. He and his guide dog, Brittany, join us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And I have to say, the first impression, you have the coolest fake eye I have ever seen.
It's got a carrot's worth of diamonds in the pupil.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, so I decided to go with a little bling style. You know, I'm a young man, why not?
Why not? I know you've spoken at many schools in Florida, where you're from, and various other places. And I know that the one thing that a lot of kids ask you is, can you take it out?
Yeah, that's always a very popular question that they have. So what I do is I just pop it out for them, you know, kind of show them what it's like. They all think it's going to be this round ball like a marble, and it looks more like a clamshell. The way it sits in the socket and moves with the muscles in there. So it looks like a clamshell. They're all blown away by that.
I could understand why. You have not made an effort to cover your scars. Your hair is still cut short. Your other eye is closed.
You don't need medals when you got scars like mine.
People understand what you've been through.
Yeah. You know, I wear them with pride.
There is a lot of changes that have happened in your life as a result of your injury. Tell us a little bit about how you lost your sight.
I was hit by a roadside bomb in Mamadi, Iraq. A couple of 155-millimeter artillery shells set on the roadside. I was sitting in the machine gun turret. Was thrown about 20 meters from the vehicle. My forehead was crushed. 45% of my cranium has been replaced with acrylic. I lost both eyes. My right hand has been completely reconstructed. I fractured my left patella, the kneecap bone. I had some soft tissue damage there, nicked my femoral artery. I was messed up pretty bad.
A couple of times you write in your blog you flatlined during surgery.
Had three different surgeries that I flatlined in. I came back. You know, you can't keep me down.
So. And that, reading your blog, that is the one thing that emerges more strongly than ever. All of the challenges that you face now, your medical challenges, obviously your sight, you see them as opportunities.
Well, you know, I've been blessed with life, definitely. I've been kept alive through this whole thing. I think that because of my injuries I've sustained, a lot of opportunities have come up. And I've been proactive in taking advantage of a lot of those. You know, every once in a while somebody will say something to me, you know, hey, you should do this or we can do this together. And I'll say to myself, self, let's take them up on this.
Well, some of those things include skydiving.
I went skydiving in Baleen, New Mexico, right outside Albuquerque. I was there for the Blinded Veterans Association National Convention.
And driving a Ferrari.
And a Dodge Viper.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, we did it in a parking lot. An empty parking lot with nobody in it. I got a lot of comments saying that I was very irresponsible and different things like that. I would like everyone to know that there was somebody in the vehicle with me. They had their hands on the steering wheel. In case anything went wrong, we did plenty of immediate action drills beforehand to just in case if this goes wrong, this is what you need to do, different things like that. So we did it as safe as we could.
But there has also been a price. For one thing, when you came home, your marriage did not survive.
No, it did not.
And that's obviously these kinds of prices. You're hardly the only veteran to come home and have that situation.
No, I think a lot of the married servicemen and women are dealing with that, especially the ones that are severely wounded, traumatically wounded. So I'm not alone in my suffering, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. We'd like to hear from members of our audience who have similar experiences, whether it was returning from the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, Gulf War I, and now Gulf War II. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And Mike Jernigan, let me ask you, how do you think, as you come back to this country, obviously you're experiencing it in a very different way without eyesight, but how do you see this country has changed since you went to war?
I think that everyone is a lot more aware of the casualties in Iraq. The media has done a great job of letting us be aware of the body count. This many civilians died. This many innocent civilians were injured. This many servicemen died. You know, I think in a way, this country has a very abstract view of the war. And if it doesn't affect them personally, then all it is a 30-second spot on the local news. I have seen, being up in the D.C. area here, some of the anti-war movement. It's definitely not reached the peak that it did in Vietnam, but I think that America is growing more and more dissatisfied with the war in Iraq. The war in Afghanistan has kind of taken a back burner to the war in Iraq. Other than that, you know, there's not too much different. I mean, the country's still around. I mean, we're still moving and hooking and jabbing.
Joining us now is Sandy Austin. She served as liaison to the governor of Nineveh Province for the U.S. Army, is now a mom-to-be. She joins us from her office in Monterey, California, on the phone. And Sandy, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And I wonder, how do you think the country's changed since you came back from the war?
I think one of my very first impressions was that all of a sudden it seemed like there was this fear being spread throughout the nation, whether it's from the TV or just media in general. But what I sensed is I came home and I felt an intense amount of security and just so safe to walk down the street and to not to worry about, is something going to blow up? Is something, you know, is one of my friends going to be injured today? And then here I am working in small town Monterey, and there's this old woman who was at the aquarium, and she comes up to me and says, oh, I was so scared at the aquarium today. I was so afraid, you know, that this would be a great spot for terrorist attack. And I just feel like this, the nation as a whole is just becoming afraid, and I don't think that fear should exist in our lives until it really has to be there.
Until it has to be there. I know that you're also a poet and a songwriter, and I wonder how has your poetry changed, been affected by your experiences in Iraq and your experiences coming home?
Well, I think prior to going, I definitely was writing about happy thoughts, and then right when I was getting ready to deploy, suddenly I was having trouble writing, and I realized I wasn't in the right state. And so I found I was writing about being afraid, and then I was over there and I was writing about Iraqis, and then I came back and there was a bit of anger in some of my writings after coming back. But
yeah, there's a chorus in one of your songs, "Where's the music? Where's the praise? Stuck in this sandbox too many days."
Exactly. And that was, I was actually pretty early in our deployment. We'd been in Kuwait a month, and then we were in Iraq only for a month, and it was, we were staying in an old Iraqi Air Force base. So there was nothing there, and I mean, we were washing our hair in the bucket, looking at the dirt ground, or, you know, porta-potties they didn't even have chemicals in the porta-potties yet for us, so there were some holes being dug. And so you just look out and all you see is dirt. We hadn't reached a city yet. We were still in basically the undeveloped parts of Iraq. So you just felt like you are in this huge sandbox, and what are we doing here? And as far as, like, where is the music, where is the praise, that is what was missing. You're here. You don't know why. You don't necessarily feel support from home. Like, where is the praise for even being here, in a sense? And I guess the music was kind of referring to here, you're hearing incoming and outgoing rounds, but where's the positive and where's the music?
Yeah. Let's get some listeners in on the line. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Our guests are Michael Jernigan and Sandy Austin, both of whom served in Iraq, and they blog on the New York Times site, Home Fires. Let's begin with Jose. Jose's calling us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I really sympathize with all the guys because I suffer the same thing. I just get out from the Army about 3 months ago. I've been suffering a lot. I suffer PTSD. My platoon, we hit a IED, and out of 19, just two survived, myself and another soldier, and that soldier died and lost to Germany. It's really hard. Like, people really don't understand. At the beginning, I was feeling lonely. You know, nobody understand what I was going through. My wife and me, we three times attempt to get divorced. We went to the lawyers. Then finally, she understand what I was going through. But at the end, you know, it's like any war. We have to go through and do the best we can to survive.
Just a couple of those acronyms, IED, Improvised Explosive Device, a Roadside Bomb, and PTSD is Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. And Mike Jernigan, I think you and Jose have a fair amount in common.
Yes, we do. You know, I can tell you, Jose, that one of the things that helped me the most is not only the writing, but talking about the things that I was dealing with, you know, talking about the emotions that were going through my head at the time. Just by getting it out into the open, I found it easier to deal with. If you keep it bottled up inside, you know, it's just going to keep turning over, and it creates a lot of resentment and different feelings that are not positive feelings. Mm. You know, for me, it was writing. I know that when I can't sleep at night, when the demons come, so to speak, I get up and I start writing on my computer, and by getting it out, it makes it easier for me. I know that there's different ways for everyone. I still have a lot of my friends that call me. You know, I get calls at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning just because they need to talk and they need somebody to listen to. And if you can find somebody that'll listen to you.
You can, at least, you know, you can talk about it. Myself, I hate talking about it. I hate when I do therapy, the VA therapy group. I can really stand on. You know,
Jose, can you stay with us on the line? We'll pick you up on the other side of the break. Stay with us, all right? You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. What are people talking about where you live? We have a new feature on our blog called Talk of Your Nation. We invite you to join us. Tell us what's being discussed around your water cooler or in your chat rooms or around your dining table. We'll consider it for the program. Go to npr.org/blogofthenation and scroll down the right-hand side to find Talk of Your Nation. Today we're talking about coming home. Our guests are Michael Jernigan and Sandy Austin. Both are Iraq War vets, and both have been blogging about their experience of returning home for the war for the New York Times blog called Home Fires. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Iraq vet named Jose is still on the line with us, calling from San Antonio. And Jose, I was wondering, Mike Jernigan was saying during the break that he maybe had some advice for helping you work through some of your experiences. Mike?
You know, Jose, it's a good thing to find a positive vent for your frustrations, for all the emotions that you're feeling. You know, for me, it was writing. For a lot of people, it's doing music or painting or anything like that. I know for a fact that when my grandfather came back from Vietnam, he built a sailboat. You know, he didn't really talk about it. He didn't like to talk about it. And one thing he did was he took all of that energy inside of him, and he built a sailboat. And after he finished his sailboat, he sold it. And I think that was one way that he dealt with his frustrations from the war.
Mm. Sandy Austin, I wondered if you wanted to weigh in on this, if you had any thoughts.
Well, I just totally agree with Mike on, for me, definitely the writing aspect. And I think even for folks who are still in Iraq, if you can take the time while you're there and actually sit down and write and just journal, or whether it's sit around with your friends and talk about it then, I think that makes coming home that much easier as well.
Jose, good luck, okay?
Thank you. Thank you so much, guys.
Hang in there.
Appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's see if we can take another call, and this is Tracy. Tracy's with us from St. Petersburg in Florida.
That's my mom.
Tracy, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Hi, Mom.
I wanted to just take this opportunity to tell Mike happy birthday. today. Today is Mike's 29th birthday.
Oh,
and just to tell him how terribly proud I am of him for everything that he has gone through, how he has come out of it. He has made everybody in our family so very proud of him, as well as all of our friends. And I just want to tell him that on air, where maybe thousands and thousands of people are listening and know how people feel about Mike.
Tracy, Mike's, remarkably, he's getting a little teary, I think.
Thank you, Mom. I love you.
I love you too, sweetheart.
Okay. Bye-bye, Tracy.
Bye-bye.
And Mike, happy birthday from all of us, too.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Andy Rosenthal. He's the editorial page editor for the New York Times. He's with us from our bureau in New York City. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And tell us a little bit about this this blog, Home Fires.
Home Fires grows out of a blog that we started called Frontlines, where we had four soldiers who were serving in Iraq who wrote for us for several months. We started in 2006. Two of them, Jeff Barnett and Lee Kelly, are part of Home Fires, and Sandy and Mike joined us for that blog, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a big part of what we do in the editorial department is to provide a forum for people to talk about important issues. And when we started creating blogs on our website, which we did fairly recently, we couldn't think of anything more important than this. And there is no group of people that is heard from less than soldiers who are actually fighting for their country.
Hmm. It's interesting. We've heard a lot of discussion during this war about the difficulties of preserving soldiers' experiences when so much of their communications with their families used to be letters in the old days. You could keep those, but now it's emails, which are sort of ephemeral,
right.
and phone calls, which are by their nature ephemeral. Blogs, I guess, are a way to preserve the experience.
Well, it's more like a letter, isn't it? You know, it's digital. I guess you can print it out and make paper out of it.
Yeah.
But at least we can keep it and we can record it, and people can react to it in ways that they never could before, too.
Hmm. And I know that this blog is it's finite. You're not going to be running it forever.
Well, nothing's forever. We've talked at various times about how long we want to keep it going, and every time we do, we look at it and realize how much life is in it. And as long as it makes sense, and as long as people like Mike and Sandy are willing to write for us, we're willing to let them be there.
Hmm. Let's see if we get another caller on the line. And this is Jim. Jim's with us from Winachapee in Washington.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah, I haven't had an opportunity to look at the blog. I would like to. I served in the Air Force for more than 21 years and was in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and then since 2003 I was in Afghanistan and Iraq and Kuwait. And, you know, I tried to record, you know, to keep a journal when I had the time to sit down and write, and the downtime was pretty hard to come by. And but I found it too difficult. And then just as I was getting ready to retire, my son was shipped over there.
Hmm.
And he just got back safely, okay.
Congratulations.
That was probably the toughest thing, knowing that I had been over there and saw what the soldiers were going through.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have my son exposed to that was really, really tough.
I bet it was. I wonder, Sandy Austin, I know you kept a journal while you were in Iraq. It can't be easy, as Jim suggests, to find the time and the motivation sometimes to sit down and write.
Absolutely, that's complete. And some of my journal is reflecting, for sure. You know, like, obviously during our commute from, or not, I guess it's not a commute, but our trek from Kuwait into Iraq, I didn't have time to sit down and write. But once we got to Pace Setter, I was able to sit down and reflect on just the thoughts that went through my head during that time. And you know, and so all of the journal isn't minute to minute, of course. But I think even with your son, sir, just... for you, maybe your son's time over there sparks memories that you've had that you didn't record, and you can actually sit down and write those down now. And that's something for your son to look back on, for his son later in life to look back on. And so I think you could still create your own history, you know.
Yeah. You know, there was Desert Shield and Desert Storm wasn't near as bad as what we're going through now. And, you know, that's why I went ahead and volunteered to head on over there.
Oh, wow.
Because they were asking for my career field for volunteers initially to augment the Army and the Marines for telecommunications. And, you know, so I based my volunteering to go on Desert Shield and Desert Storm, and so it was pretty tough. It was pretty tough. And telecommunications is, you know, everybody wants the latest and greatest, and they want it first. And so I stayed pretty busy, and that's probably the only thing that really helped me survive through it was the fact that I was so busy keeping up with everybody's requests that I didn't really have time to sit down and think about the dangers that we were exposed to. And then every morning and every briefing, we're talking about IEDs and, you know, this person and that person and the flights to Landstuhl. It's just one thing after another. And
Landstuhl, really, the big hospital in Germany, yeah. I know Mike
Jernigan really was there. It didn't start sinking in until I got back and then was getting ready to retire, and then my son was heading over there, and I was like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Do you wish you'd had a journal that you had kept that you could have shown him to give him some idea of what he's going into?
I don't know that it would have done any good because he was in the Army and didn't have a choice to go. You know, he had to go.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Jim, congratulations that your son is back, and again, congratulations on your service, too.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate the phone call. I wonder, Andy Rosenthal, what's it like working with his editorial page at Writer? You work with a lot of professional writers, so these are, for the most part, non-professionals.
That's true, although people write now more than they ever did before in public. I haven't had the privilege of editing this blog myself. Peter Catapano, who's one of our editors, has done that, and he's found it to be a really interesting experience. The point here is not to try to turn what they write into make it sound like I wrote it, but to make it sound like they wrote it. And we do very little editing. I think that's true. You guys can tell better than I do. But the idea is to give voice to these people, not to turn it into a New York Times editorial.
Well, Mike Jernigan, what's your experience of writing for the New York Times been like?
I refer to Andy as the man. The man. He, I had one phrase that needed to be cut out, but I'll tell you, Peter does a good job of editing.
I remember that.
He pretty much what
just
I
one
write,
of those phrases we can't use on the radio?
I don't know, and I won't say it just in case. But, you know, Peter does a really good job of editing. I know that what I send him always makes it onto the website with the real intention and the meaning of what I wanted it to mean. Mm. And it does sound like it came from me. He doesn't change anything. You know, sometimes he'll shoot it back with some questions for me to elaborate on different things. But other than that, you know, I don't notice much at all.
Mm. Sandy, what about you? Has been working with an editor at the Times made you a better writer?
Oh, yeah, I feel like Peter's great. I think kind of the same thing Mike said. He really just crosses the T's, dots the I's, you know, beautifies it a little bit. But for the most part, he keeps it exactly, you know, pretty much what I sent to him. Mm-hmm. And what I like that he does is if I've written something that brings up a question in his mind that he knows the readers are going to question, that's what his comment would be. Can you expand on this? You know, so in general, yeah, I think it's great working with him, and you definitely learn.
Mm. I could use Peter for some of my college papers.
Yeah, maybe a little freelance work for him.
We'll see what we can do.
Here's an email question from Mark in Minneapolis. As vets, are you getting the help you need? What should we, all of us, be doing to help? Why don't we hear from you first, Sandy?
Well, honestly, for me, I came back healthy. I feel great. I'm actually out of the military now. I guess if anything... Just the support of, you know, just knowing if you know someone was over there, have the common courtesy, like, not to ask the question, what was the worst thing that happened? You know, just things like that. Or if you are interested, ask and accept, you know, listen to the stories. And I guess that's kind of a tough question because I don't have any true difficulties.
No. What about you, Mike? Are you getting the help you need?
I'm getting everything I needed. I think that a lot of our traumatically wounded, as severe as I was, are going right into the VA system pretty well. I heard Secretary Nicholson say at the National Press Club that the VA's got a 177-day backlog on disability claims. I think that if people want to help, call your congressman, call your elected officials, tell them to pressure the VA to get off their butt and process these claims quicker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I agree with Sandy. You know, it's nice when I enjoy it when people come up to me and tell me thank you for my service. You know, I'm very open about everything. I've had people ask me, you know, questions that are, you know, very intense questions to very stupid questions, like how do I use the bathroom because I'm blind, you know, just different things. But, you know, if you want to know, ask the questions. Usually the veteran will tell you whether it's appropriate or not. But definitely be appreciative, say thank you. We appreciate it when people say thank you.
Mm. We're talking today about the experience of coming home through the lens of the Home Fires blog, which is run by the New York Times. Our guests are two of the bloggers, Michael Jernigan, a retired Marine corporal, and Sandy Austin, who is retired from the Army. Also with us, Andy Rosenthal, the editorial page editor of the New York Times. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Mike, and Mike's with us from Fort Mitchell in Kentucky.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, please.
I want to thank the people for being in the service. I was an infantry sergeant in Vietnam, right on the Central Highlands on the Laos and Cambodian border when I got wounded. I spent about a year in training, about 7 months in combat, and literally lived like an animal. And then about 8 months being put back together after I was 35 men that were left out of three companies, and we got hit with 122 mortar rounds. Got an RPG directly on an overnight two-man fighting bunker, and then they threw a satchel charge in, which is nothing but a high explosive equivalent of a stick and a half of dynamite. And when I came back, I was married. And my wife came and stayed with me for 7 months on an amputee ward. And we watched, and I was an old man, I was 24. We watched these young men come back as little tigers, and as the military got to the point where they were going to wash them out, and they got scared to death. Okay. When I came back, I went to school for 6 years at night and worked full-time at the phone company at night, and at that time, they had to take you back.
Mm-hmm.
Worked there before I got. I think where I screwed up is I told them I was from Kentucky and liked to hunt. Right on my forehead. But I took advantage of the VA rehab, and that's a big, big, big advantage. They pay for your books, your pencils, they give you a stipend for housing, things like that. It's a very, very good program. Mike's probably familiar with that.
Yes, I am.
And in my particular case, my wife and I, and we had to adopt our children. And we had a third one through a special procedure. But in my case, I was so busy for the first 5 years, and at the end of those 5 or 6 years at night and working, going to school, and we had three kids at the end of those 6 years, that life just ate us up and took us on. We didn't have time to even, and part of that was PTSD. We didn't realize that. But in combat, particularly in infantry, there is no timeout. It's the last man standing that counts in the Jolly Green Giant theory. And however you get there, that's the only thing that counts.
What brought you out the other side, do you think, Mike?
I don't know that I ever did. I didn't have any close friends at work, don't have any close friends around me. My wife is the one that kept me together, gave me the reason to do what I did. I was going to get a master's degree, but, and I don't mean this in a negative stance, but I went 6 months to a master's at Xavier University, and I worked at the phone company, and they gave you a little card. It says there'll be so many EEO had set in, and this is...
Equal opportunity employment.
And they said, you know, there'll be so many whites, zero males, and so many others, and EEO was good and bad. But I had lost 10 years of my life and going to school and going to combat, and I was going to engineering school before I went into service. I volunteered for the draft because we couldn't get a house. We were scared to death to have children. I don't know. I had a wreck in about 1969 and had a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this has come back, and I've discovered I have a what's called a syringal myelia in my spine. It's my spinal cord's expanding. And,
oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Joined Paralyzed Veterans of America. But right now, I'm still vertical and moving on. And
well, Mike,
take advantage of your retirement, Mike, if you've got it.
Thank you. I do have a nice one.
Nice places to go.
And, Mike, thank you for sharing your story, and good luck to you.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate the phone call.
Bye-bye.
And thanks to all of our guests today for coming in and sharing their stories, too. You can read more about Sandy Austin and Mike Jernigan's return home on the Home Fires blog at the New York Times. Michael Jernigan, thanks very much for coming in. Good luck in college.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Sandy Austin, I understand you're pregnant. Great. Good luck with that.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. And also with us, Andy Rosenthal, editorial page editor of the New York Times, with us from our bureau in New York, and we appreciate your time today, too.
It was a pleasure.
And again, Mike Jernigan, happy birthday. And we have to say goodbye, of course, to your dog, Brandy. Nice to hear it come. Brittany, excuse me. Thanks. Thank her for coming in.